The subject of the lecture this evening, Where is History Going?, is also the title of a book of mine, and I'm going to be following quite closely the argument of that book in what I present. This is an attempt to set forth a Christian philosophy of history over against four of the most prominent secular philosophies of history in modern times. The philosophies of Hegel, of Marx, of Spengler, and Toynbee. The general thrust of this argument is that the secular philosophies of history that have arisen since the Enlightenment fail because of a certain logical problem, not because of a lack of effort or of goodwill on the part of those who have presented these philosophies. There is a particular logical problem built in to an attempt to determine the meaning of history from the standpoint of modern secularism. And we're going to use these four philosophies as illustrative of this problem. Then we're going to move ahead to present the Christian philosophy of history as an alternative to the fundamental problem which lies at the root of each of these perspectives. We won't attempt this evening to provide a justification of the Christian philosophy of history in terms of the empirical or historical evidence for it. That was our endeavor last evening. We tried to show last evening that if the ordinary canons of historical investigation are applied to the case for the Christian faith, and if the case for the Christian faith is viewed from the standpoint of our method of arbitrating such questions in society, namely the evidential methods of the common law, the result is that Christianity is vindicated. We won't be repeating that kind of argument tonight. What we're trying to do tonight is to approach the same general area of the verification of Christianity another way, by showing the necessary logical problems that lie at the root of alternative views, and then to show what the Christian answer is to those viewpoints. If in the question period that follows the lecture you would like to go back to questions of the historical soundness of the Christian claim, or the evidential value of the Christian claim, you're more than welcome to do this, and this would certainly be an ideal time to deal with any questions along that line, since it is our final session. Henry Ford is said to have divined history as the succession of one damn thing after another. This is a definition of history which has a certain theological merit, which Ford was certainly unaware of. But the point of the definition is to say that history isn't going anywhere, that an attempt to understand universal history is doomed from the outset. That kind of historical skepticism has been particularly characteristic of the West since the First World War, and extending particularly into the period after the Second World War. The attitude of people toward history is not merely that history is bunk, but that questions posed relative to the meaning of history are simply unanswerable. It's like the question that Edith Stein posed on her deathbed. She asked, "What is the answer?" And when none came, she said, "What then is the question?" The point being that the answer is impossible because the question is impossible. Nonetheless, as we look back across the centuries, we find that people are continually plagued by the meaning of history. This is a question that can't be eliminated in the facile manner of Henry Ford's aphorism. It's a question that people find themselves posing whether they like it or not. It's really a special case of the general philosophical problem of the one and the many. Perhaps the most perennial problem in the history of philosophy is bringing unity out of diversity. William James said that we come into the world entering a blooming, buzzing confusion. The child, as he enters the world, finds the universe a blooming, buzzing confusion. The diversity of data is so extensive. The material of the world is so confusing that it becomes essential to try to bring some order out of this. The effort is therefore made from the beginning of time to discover some single thread, some explanation that can deal with the vast diversity of data. Philosophy of history is attempting that sort of thing with reference to one area of human experience, with reference to the area of human history. And the attempts from Herodotus and Thucydides on to Spengler and Toynbee make it perfectly plain that the question appears and reappears and cannot be eliminated. Since the beginning of the modern secular era, since that point which C.S. Lewis spoke of as the great divide between classical Christian civilization on the one hand and modern secular civilization on the other, there have been numerous attempts to offer an explanation to history, to provide a one that can connect up the many, a single understanding or interpretation that can provide some sense to the blooming and buzzing confusion of history. And what we want to do is to talk very briefly about the four major conceptions that have tried to deal with the diversity of historical data since the beginning of the modern secular era. In the 19th century, the two greatest attempts to deal with the meaning of history certainly were the attempts of Hegel and Marx. In the 20th century, Spengler and Toynbee have endeavored to work on this same problem and have done perhaps the most impressive work. Let's begin with Hegel. Hegel's philosophy was more influential in the 19th century than any other philosophy. In fact, from a philosophical standpoint, Hegel was the 19th century. It's been said by at least one wag that you can determine the decade of a philosophical work in the 19th century, stemming from the German philosophical tradition, very largely by weighing it. The heavier it is, the later it is, because it's necessary for each variant of Hegel to refute the previous variations before setting forth his own viewpoint. Thus, the works of the Hegelians and neo-Hegelians in the 19th century become steadily heavier in bulk, if not in quality. Hegel's viewpoint is a dynamic ideological center for the 19th century. Hegelian philosophy is idealistic philosophy in the sense that for Hegel, ideas determine everything else. Ideas are fundamental to the understanding of man's existence. Of course, Hegel was not the first idealist in the history of philosophy. As Whitehead said, all of Western philosophy is a footnote to Plato. And if you're talking about idealism, you think immediately of Plato. But the difference between Platonic idealism and Hegelian idealism is essentially where the ideas or ideals are located. Plato located the ideas or ideals transcendentally in a realm beyond that of ordinary human experience. Nothing in ordinary human experience perfectly represented the ideal. Plato, for example, illustrated this concept by way of mathematical figures. You can conceive of an ideal triangle, but you can't draw it. No matter how hard you work, the triangle that you produce is going to be short of perfection. Yet you know what that would consist of. The ideal triangle, or the idea of the triangle, is something that never can be realized in ordinary experience. It's something that exists in a qualitatively different sphere. It exists in the realm of the ideas or ideals. Hegel, on the other hand, was convinced that the ideas or ideals are resident within the operations of history themselves. Hegel's idealism is not transcendental, it is immanent. It is not transcendent, it's immanent. That is to say, it operates within the structures of life rather than apart from them. For Hegel, there is an immanent ideal which comes about through a peculiar process known as the dialectic, or, putting it another way, it expresses itself through dialectic process. By dialectic, Hegel means that ideas spawn their opposites. And in the struggle between an idea and its contrary, a modification occurs, a new concept occurs, which partakes of the elements both of the original idea and its opposite. Hegel talked about these ideas as thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. The original idea, the thesis, spawns the antithesis, and in the dynamic struggle between them, a synthesis is produced. The synthesis, in turn, becomes a new thesis, which in turn creates its opposite, a new antithesis, and out of that struggle comes a new synthesis, and so on. Bigger bugs have littler bugs upon their backs to bite them, and littler bugs have littler bugs, and so ad infinitum. The dialectic continues in this manner, but it doesn't end up ad infinitum. It ends up in a positive goal for history, and the positive goal is the goal of freedom. Hegel was convinced that working through this dialectic process of thesis and antithesis, civilization moves onward and upward to higher and higher levels and finally issues out into the perfect resolution, which is the goal of freedom. Why does this occur? Because the world spirit of reason immanentizes the ideal through this kind of operation. Hegel conceived the history of the world as consisting of four epochs. And these epochs are the Oriental, the Greek, the Roman, and the Germanic. The Oriental, the Greek, the Roman, and the Germanic. And in moving through these four world historical epochs, finally one reaches the Germanic epoch, which is on the very verge of the ideal society. It is indeed the Germanic society that provides the final crucible in which the perfect goal of freedom appears. Hegel felt that the ordinary standards of good and evil cannot be applied to this process, particularly when the great hour of a nation strikes. At this point, the nation becomes a vehicle for the world spirit of reason, and the nation and its leaders will very often transcend ordinary standards, ordinary moral standards, in carrying on to the goal. Now, what can be said about this kind of viewpoint? Well, for one thing, we immediately recognize that it was subject to Hegel's own historical limitations. To Hegel, it looked as if everything was coming up Germanic. And that isn't a peculiar perspective for a person in his particular historical situation, because, as I'm sure you realize, Germany had for centuries been a decentralized, weak area, not a national state, a collection of little states, territorial areas. At the time of the 30 Years' War, there were some 365 of these, and the country was, for this reason, continually run over by those nations that had reached powerful national statehood. France made life especially miserable for the Germans during the period we think of as early modern times. Finally, however, as a result of the appearance of the Prussian military class and the development of a strong aristocracy, a military aristocracy, especially in Prussia, it was possible for the Germans to achieve national statehood. And in doing this, the result was finally the defeat of France and the emergence of Germany as a major power. This kind of thing was going on when Hegel was presenting his view of history. And the result of this was, surely, that he saw in his own people the possibility of a determinative element in the ongoing process of history, and perhaps even a kind of apocalyptic view of his nation's function. Beyond this, however, we must look at the dialectic and ask ourselves whether such a process necessarily exists, and if it does exist, whether it necessarily would produce those results. There is an implicit assumption in Hegel that if dialectic process operates, it operates in the direction of the positive. It operates toward the emergence of a greater good. Thesis and antithesis and synthesis move onward and upward. Why is Hegel a kind of central figure in 19th century philosophy? Mostly because the entire 19th century thought progress. If there is a single theme in the 19th century, it's surely the theme of progress. It's not strange in the least that when Darwin's Origin of Species was published in 1859, the New York Times reviewer said, "How wonderful, Darwin is simply illustrating what we knew already, namely that civilization inevitably evolves, it inevitably moves on to higher levels." Now, of course, Darwin hadn't shown anything of the kind. Even if Darwin's investigation is regarded as correct, it certainly didn't have that wide an application to human culture. But the 19th century thought that way. This was the century of big business here in the United States. It was the Horatio Alger century for us here in America. It was a century of idealistic progress. The year of revolutions, 1848, gave many people the conviction that the world was on the verge of moving on to a kind of millennium. Hegel implicitly was convinced that this process would move on to positive results. But of course, it doesn't have to do this at all. It's possible for a very unpleasant idea to spawn an even more unpleasant idea, and out of it to get a miserable idea. You can, for example, have a safecracker present a superlative idea for taking the local bank, and in contact with an explosives expert of equally doubtful moral convictions, a new plan arises through the argument between them, which results not only in getting the stuff out of the bank, but killing all the people in it. This kind of thing is perfectly possible. In other words, the notion of dialectic isn't automatically a positive notion. There isn't any built-in moral value in it, nor is there any built-in indicator that it's going to move onward and upward. It could conceivably move downward and to a less satisfactory result. What we see then in the Hegelian system is what we today would regard as a naive assumption as to the necessitarian character of things getting better and better. Let's move on now quickly to Karl Marx. Marx said that he turned Hegel on his head. A very awkward sort of analogy, really. One cannot imagine Hegel upside down, really. Hegel is not the kind of person that you can think of in those terms. But what Marx meant by that was that he took a fundamental concept in the Hegelian system and reversed it. And the fundamental concept is the very concept of idealism. For Marx, the fundamental determinative element is not ideological. It isn't ideas that determine the essence of things. It is matter. It is material substance. What Marx talks about is a materialistic view of the dialectic process and a materialistic determination of the progress of history. For Marx, the important elements that enter into the dialectic of history are material things and not ideas. It's the material things that yield the ideas and not the other way around. The system that Marx set forth is a monolithic system in that each of the elements of it work in relation to each other, and the whole of it creates a magnificent and impressive system. We could easily diagram this with a pyramid. A pyramid is a good diagram to represent a monolithic system, because we have here a monolith. And the base of the monolith is the materialistic metaphysic, the conviction that fundamentally it's material things that determine other things. Built on this materialistic assumption is the dialectic. What dialectic? Why, Hegel's dialectic. But what enters into it is not ideas. What enters into it is material things. And more specifically, in the area of economics, we arrive at particular concepts that show us what determines the course of history. The economic theory of surplus value is fundamental to the Marxist ideology. What is this notion? Well, it says, in effect, that because of an inequity in the ownership of the means of production in society, there is a built-in destructive tendency. The people who own the means of production in society invariably grind down on those who don't. They don't realize that their true capital happens to be the workers, the people who don't own the means of production. So, not recognizing this, they make life more and more miserable for those who are not in the position that they are, and in doing this, they destroy their own capital. Thus, as the owners of the means of production grind down on those who don't own it, not only are the people ground down upon crushed, but this destroys those who are grinding down on them as well. The result of this is inevitably class war. Why is it inevitable? Because eventually the people being ground down upon realize, in the words of the conclusion of the of Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto, that they have nothing to lose but their chains. Revolt becomes the lesser of evils, because if they don't do this, they are going to be totally destroyed. The result is a class war, and since they're the ones who have nothing to lose, they're the ones who win. And of course, this is also because of the fact that the capitalist has become a fat cat in the course of grinding down upon them and is not really in a position to oppose the kind of concerted effort that they exercise. Class war occurs, and out of it comes a classless society. But it occurs really in two stages. The classless society proper comes after a dictatorship of the proletariat. The dictatorship of the proletariat is a cleanup period, really. During it, those who have previously been ground down upon eliminate the last vestiges of the inequities which caused the problem. And once these inequities have been eliminated, then the state winnows away. The state is no longer necessary, because the state, after all, is a means of upholding the inequities, and once the inequities have disappeared, the state is no longer necessary. The law also disappears, incidentally, because the law is regarded as having the same kind of function. Finally, the dictatorship of the proletariat disappears in the classless society. And in the classless society, in a sense, the capitalist lion lies down with the proletarian lamb, and all is well. Actually, there are no lions left, evidently, there are only lambs. And a situation arises which is the materialistic counterpart of Hegel's goal of societal freedom. In other words, in Hegel, the dialectic of ideas produces a perfect society of freedom. In Marx, a dialectic of materialism produces a classless society. The two systems are remarkably similar. In a very real sense, Marx knew what he was talking about when he said that he turned Hegel on his head. The fundamental systems are remarkably similar. In a very real sense, Marx knew what he was talking about when he said that he turned Hegel on his head. The fundamental operation is the same, but this is conceived of as a materialistic dialectic process producing the perfect society, while this is an idealistic operation. The inevitable notion of progress is as fundamental to the second system as it is to the first. Marx is as much a product of the 19th century as Hegel. In both instances, the inevitable progress is seen as the essence of the whole operation. As some Marxist theorists have emphasized by analogy today, it's as if the universe were an escalator. It's as if human history were an escalator. And there are really two choices. You can sit down on the escalator and fold your arms and refuse to believe the thing is moving. Or you can move with it. But whether you sit down and refuse to do anything, or whether you move with it, you're going to get to the same goal, because this is an inevitable kind of progress created by dialectic necessity. Well, what's the problem with this? Rather, what are the problems with it? Because this is a system which has great aesthetic force and an impressive monolithic character, but which has all kinds of hidden assumptions and difficulties with it. For one thing, the materialistic base. Hegel assumes that things are going to operate idealistically. Marx assumes that they're going to operate materialistically. Which is it? Well, that's sort of like the question, have you stopped beating your wife? It's exceedingly difficult to answer that kind of question in any single sense, because obviously both ideas and material things enter into all of life. Some events can be more readily and easily explained by an appeal to material factors. Other events can be more readily explained by an appeal to ideas. The trouble with these systems is that they insist that you take one explanation as the root explanation of all. Now, the standard Marxist argument is, if people don't eat, they don't do anything else. And of course, there's an element of truth to this. Had Bach not eaten, the chances are he would not have produced the B minor mass. But whether it follows that the B minor mass is best explained by his diet is something else. Marx was deeply influenced by Ludwig Feuerbach. Feuerbach wrote a work entitled The Essence of Christianity. And in this work and other writings of Feuerbach, he set forth an aphorism which is, der Mensch ist, was ist. A man is what he eats. It comes out much better in German because of the ist and ist. He suggested that philosophers would do well to eat a diet of dried beans. It's unclear exactly why he felt that this was the case. I have a suspicion why it might be the case, but I certainly won't go into any such physiological discussion tonight. The question is not whether eating is significant. The question is not whether materialistic factors enter into all things. Yes, they clearly do. The question is whether this is the most ready explanation to deal with all of the phenomena of history. Surely in certain instances, these kinds of data are most useful and helpful. For example, you don't understand the Italian Renaissance and its origins unless you realize that the trade in the Mediterranean shifted from the Muslims to the Venetians and other Italians early in the Middle Ages, and the wealth finally poured in, and as a result of the wealth there was patronage, and as a result of the patronage it was possible for the kind of magnificent artistic creations to be promoted that were promoted during the Renaissance. Surely such factors are significant, but do they adequately explain the Mona Lisa? Do they adequately explain the Sistine Chapel? Obviously, it's necessary for various factors to enter in. The dialectic we've already talked about. Marx, like Hegel, assumes that the dialectic has got to carry things onward and upward. Not necessarily. Not necessarily. To say nothing about the question of how you justify the notion that all things must work dialectically. That things often do work dialectically, we won't argue, but must they work dialectically? They've got to work dialectically in order for this to be an inevitable sequence, and that's a moot point. The economic theory of surplus value. Marx thought that the only way that the economic inequities could possibly be taken care of would be by class war. He didn't conceive of the possibility that the disenfranchised, the workers, those who don't own the means of production, could combine in such a way that the pressure that they place on the situation would be, if anything, greater than the pressure put on by the capitalist. He also didn't conceive of government intervening to such an extent that it wouldn't be possible for this situation to blow up. As it stands today, one could well argue that the average worker, who often owns the means of production himself through stock ownership in the company in which he works, is more interested in good television reception than he is in building bombs of plastique in his basement on Saturdays. And the reason for this is that he's been able to take care of these inequities in other ways. Maybe not ideal ways, but he certainly has been able to deal with this problem in such a way that he doesn't apparently feel that it's necessary to carry the situation to the point of class war and ultimate realignment of society. Suppose the war does occur, and suppose we end up with a dictatorship of the proletariat. Marx assumes naively again that this dictatorship is going to winnow away. There isn't any evidence in history that dictatorships ever winnow away. As Lord Acton said at the turn of the century, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the tendency is for dictatorships to get harder and tighter and stiffer, not for them to disappear. A classless society is an interesting idea, but we've never seen any such thing. Milovan Delos, the Yugoslavian who has spent a good deal of his career in jail, Tito and he never got along very well, Milovan Delos wrote a work entitled The New Class. And the argument of this work is that after a Marxist revolution, you certainly do get an elimination of classes that have previously existed, but you don't get a classless society. What you get is a new class. It consists of the bureaucratic members of the party who establish a new social structure, and the new social structure benefits certain people rather than others, and those who are benefited are not interested in giving that up. Thus, we have leaders of the new state having the limousines that were previously owned by the king or whoever happens to have been eliminated. We don't have everyone riding on bicycles. And the classless society, nobody's seen it. It's very much like Hegel's goal of freedom. It's a lovely idea. We wish that that were the case, but it doesn't seem to have any realistic connection with life as we know it. If we move on to our own century, we come across two interpreters of history who present a very different kind of notion to these, but a notion which has definite connections with what we've talked about. Oswald Spengler, in his Decline of the West, argues that it's possible to distinguish fundamental societal types. And these fundamental societal types, or cultures, can be analyzed historically in terms of a pattern of growth and maturity and decay and death. It's possible, says Spengler, to map the cultures of the past, and we find that they all operate in an organic life cycle. They operate by analogy with human lifespan. They go through a growth and a decay and a death parallel to the lives of individual human beings. And if we can establish that kind of situation relative to past civilizations, it ought to be possible to take our own civilization and put that on the same paper, to do an overlay, if you will, with our civilization there, and by careful alignment of what has occurred in our own civilization, determine where it stands in this kind of pattern. And the conclusion to which Spengler came is indicated by the title of his great work, The Decline of the West. He sees the West in its decline. A very interesting notion. Here an effort is made to examine past civilizations and see what's happening there, and then to take the present civilization and see it in that kind of alignment. Toynbee did a great deal of work with Spengler's theory and has been one of its most severe critics. Toynbee points out that there is no necessity, of a present civilization following the same pattern as past civilizations, even if we admit that the past civilizations have gone through such cycles. And this is a very important point logically. How would you know that a future civilization would have to do what a past one did, even if all of the past ones had gone through that pattern? You might feel a great deal of pressure in that direction, but it certainly wouldn't be a matter of logical necessity. But more than that, as the critics have pointed out, Spengler has tended to force civilizations into a pattern of organic life cycle. He assumes that they're going to operate that way, therefore he sees that sort of thing occurring. What he tends to do is to create a Procrustean bed. You remember good old Procrustes, an early Greek innkeeper. No, he was a mythical figure who enjoyed having visitors, because Procrustes had only one bed in his place, and this bed was of a certain size. And when a visitor came who was too short, Procrustes stretched him until he fit the bed. And if the visitor was too long, Procrustes cut him off on either end until he fit the bed. The idea was that everybody was going to fit that bed. And an analysis of Spengler's Decline of the West shows a similar kind of phenomenon going on here. Spengler is not entirely aware of this, but the civilizations are forced into this kind of mold.